Blog Talk Radio.
Like the folks you meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn Bridge. What a lovely view from heaven looks at you from the Brooklyn Bridge. I love to listen to the wind through her strings, the song that she sings for the town. I love to look up at the clouds in her hair. She's learned to wear like a crown. If you've been a rover, journey's end lies over the Brooklyn Bridge. Don't let no one tell you, I've been trying to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. All the folks in Manhattan are sad, 'cause they look at her and wish they had the good old Brooklyn Bridge. If you've been a rover, journey's end lies over the Brooklyn Bridge. Don't let no one tell you that I've been trying to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. You'll miss her most when you roam, 'cause you'll think of her and think of home, the good old Brooklyn. You meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn Bridge. What a lovely view from heaven looks at you from the Brooklyn Bridge. I love to listen to the wind through her strings, song that she sings for the town. I love to look up at the clouds in her hair. She's learned to wear like a crown. If you've been a rover, journey's end lies over the Brooklyn Bridge. Don't let no one tell you, I've been trying to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. All the folks in Manhattan are sad, 'cause they look at her and wish they had the good old Brooklyn.
Welcome, everybody, to Howe's New York with Brooklyn real estate attorney Robert Howe. Tonight we're going to be looking at a legal topics episode, and here is our host, as always, Robert Howe.
Well, welcome, everyone, and thank you, Jason, to Howe's New York. I'm your host again, Robert Howe, and we're talking about a multitude of topics, including real estate, community, politics, and any hot topics of the day. We're broadcasting from an undisclosed location in Brooklyn, New York, to a potential audience stretching from Longyearbyen, Norway, to Ushuaia, Tierra del Fuego, thanks to the power of Blog Talk Radio. I'm here with my executive producer, Jason Versace, of Rising Tide Marketing. And tonight is one of our topics, our legal topics show, and tonight we've chosen to talk about mortgages and getting out from under them after a divorce. What happens to mortgages after parties decide to break up, split up, and divorce? So I usually start off by asking Jason what his thought is, what happens to a mortgage once the parties walk out of Supreme Court and are divorced.
Well, I guess that's probably the stickiest situation you might find yourself in when you're worrying about a mortgage. Guess one of the easiest way would probably be to sell the house and pay off the mortgage.
Well, you have chosen the most practical and reasonable thing to do, but fortunately for us lawyers, clients don't always choose the easy and practical thing to do, and they and thus we make some additional business out of it. Sadly, not it is a sad situation, divorce, but many people decide upon a variety of different results, you know, when it comes to home ownership. Yes, selling it to somebody else, everybody moving out, seems the logical and most easiest way of doing it. But parties do come up, concoct, you know, different variations. Sometimes when a spouse has, when a, the custodial spouse, many times the mother, has custody of young children, the courts and the attorneys are reluctant to cause a move, a split up of the house, and cause everybody to be displaced. So they'll come up with some sort of a solution that the custodial parent and the children can live in the house until, say, maybe the children become 18 or get out of college or things like that. Other times, if children are not involved, one spouse may need to stay in the house for a while for a variety of reasons, and the parties agree that sometime in the future that they may sell the house. Coupled with that, Jason, the hot market in Brooklyn real estate. So, you know, $1 million house today could easily be 1.5, 2.0 over the next 10 years. And if parties are staying in the house, questions come up as to, you know, who's entitled to, you know, benefit from that, you know, that appreciation and value. So it is a kind of interesting topic. And, of course, to further confuse things, let's not forget about the bank. You know, the bank, the major investor here, they've probably given the parties 80% of the value of the house in a loan. And they certainly are going to have a very big say, if not the say, in how, you know, things ultimately, you know, get involved. But why don't we talk about first a mortgage? What does that really mean? You know, people use that term very loosely, but lawyers and many people believe that a mortgage is just one thing, one document, one agreement, when really a mortgage is comprised of just about two documents. So when you talk about buying a house and getting a mortgage, you end up going to a closing and the bank will come along and give you 80% if that's what you've applied for. And you will sign a variety of documents that the bank prepares. But the most important two documents that you will sign is a document called a note and a document surprisingly called a mortgage. Now, a note is an IOU. It says you owe the bank, Citibank, Chase, Wells, whatever, has lent $100,000 to the Joneses, and they've lent it to them for 30 years, and the Joneses are going to pay it back at about, you know, 3 or 4 or 5% interest. Now, we all know that IOUs are as good as the paper that they're written on. There is a legal and moral obligation to pay them back, But if a person doesn't want to, that's a job for the lender to sue and collect. And even more difficult is if the borrower can't pay it back, if they've incurred some difficult financial situation, lost their job, stock market went south, the value of their house went south, and they find themselves, you know, even though they want to, would like to, are unable to pay off the note. So the first document is called a note. The note is the IOU, where it says, I personally promise that I will pay back Citibank the $100,000 that I owe them over the next 30 years at 3 or 4 or 5% interest. Now, being that the note is as good as the paper it's written on, banks like the term we hear, security. And security comes in the form of a mortgage. In other states, they call them different things, but in New York State, we call them mortgages. And mortgages really say, all right, we know that you signed the IOU to the bank, and to collateralize or make it better or to make it firmer or stronger or more in our favor, we, the bank, are going to have a security interest in your house. And that means if you don't pay your note, the bank could try to foreclose against your property pursuant to the terms of the mortgage and then kick you out and take the house back. So curiously, a bank could do two things to you in terms of foreclosing on a mortgage. They could sue you on the note, the IOU, and probably win, and simultaneously sell or foreclose on your house, take title to it, and kick you out. So the term mortgage, meaning the note and the document called a mortgage, is a pretty powerful security instrument that lenders have to make sure that you pay back your loan.
So are there any other instances that you could think of or that you've come across where the circumstances weren't the circumstances that existed when you, in terms of owning a property or owning a home, when you made the agreement with the bank, everything was determined to be X, and now maybe 6 months or a year in or 2 years into it, the situation now is Y. Is there any other extenuating circumstances where you might run into a sticky situation with being on the hook to the bank for the mortgage?
Well, what you suggest, Jason, usually comes up quite often in the area of divorces. A change in, you're happily married, you buy the house, you both go to the bank, the closing, you both sign all the papers, your names are on the deeds, your names are on the note, and your names are on the mortgages. And banks like to have a lot of people sign those documents, obviously only buyers, but the more people that are on the note and the mortgage, the happier the bank is, because the more people that they could potentially go after to try and collect for their loan. So you start out as a happily married couple, and you buy your house, and a couple years into it, you've been paying your mortgage, and then there's a bump in the road. You decide you can't live together anymore, and you want to split up, and you both retain attorneys, and those attorneys go to court, and ultimately you end up getting divorced and splitting up your assets. Well, the thing that's not so splittable is your house with a mortgage on it. Because what happens in this situation is that you have an outside player involved in your divorce all of a sudden called the bank. The bank really doesn't care that you got divorced. all it cares about is that it still has two people on the loan, and those two people should keep paying their mortgage. And they really don't care how you go about it. They just want to keep getting their mortgage payments. Now, that presents a problem to a lot of couples. You know, they have this, probably the biggest asset that they have. You know, they could split up bank accounts. They just go to the bank and, you know, maybe open two accounts and split the money, or you take one account, I take the other account. Those things are relatively splittable. You could split stocks. You could split your pension because there's nobody really else involved in that asset. But when it comes to your house with a mortgage on it or a loan against it, the bank is involved. The bank takes the position, hey, we have husband and wife who signed all these papers, and we want to keep them on, you know, the documents, and we want to make sure we have them both as potential people to go after in the event that they stop paying. So now, at the end of the divorce, you have this big asset, and you have a party involved, the bank, who's really not involved in the divorce, never shows up in court, never, you know, sends attorneys, never is consulted. But at the end of it, you know, they do become a major player. So the bank's philosophy is, if you signed it, you owe it, and your name is going to remain on the paperwork till death do you part. Even if the divorce papers say, oh, so-and-so will be responsible for the house, and you know, we'll let the custodial parent live in the house until the youngest child becomes 18, and then it will be sold. Both parents, the parent who is living in the house and the parent who has had to move out of the house, are both still liable on the mortgage. So if you want to stay in the house after the mortgage, there are a few techniques that you could use. But let's hold that thought for a second. If you decide that you're not, that no one has real ties to the house, that there are no reasons why the house should be kept, obviously the easiest resolution is to sell the house. You would go to a closing. You'd be represented by one or two attorneys, or both your matrimonial attorneys. You'd sell your house. All the expenses would come off the top, the brokers, the transfer taxes, the mortgage, etc., and you'd end up with a net, and that net would be split, you know, among the parties, however the lawyers agree. But that's a little too easy, because most couples, for one reason or another, want to stay in the house, either because of young children, or they have a real strong tie to the house, or it was part of the whole negotiation that one spouse could live in the house for a period of time, or one spouse loves the house so much they want to try to keep it. That's all fine and well, but the spouse that doesn't have those same sentiments or doesn't have the children or has no ties to the property says, look, I want to get out, and you may not have to give me my money right away, but I don't want to be beholden on this $100,000 loan, because this is going to hold me back when I try to do other, you know, credit-related transactions. And or if the spouse who's staying in the house doesn't pay the mortgage, both that spouse and me are going to be sued by the bank and foreclosed upon, and that's going to be a black mark against my credit. So people think that it's a relatively easy thing to have their name taken off of the loan. That's wrong. It could occur, but probably 90 times out of 100, it is not going to occur. Because the bank says, look, we lent you the $100,000 based upon both of your GORs and your earning income potential. And we like it that way. We like two people, you know, to be responsible. We don't want to let one off the hook and be stuck with the other one who might not be as strong of an earner as the other one. So there is a concept called assumption of the loan, where one spouse could go to the bank and try to convince them that they are the higher income earner, they have good credit, and that the other spouse should be let off, you know, the loan. That occasionally happens. There is a concept called assumption of the loan, where some of the parties on the mortgage get off, maybe new people get on, or maybe just a few people remain. But that concept isn't all that popular in the real estate world. What is probably the more popular, or the easier, or the doable, I should say, is just to do a refinance. Just like if you were married and you saw that the rates had gone down and that you had more equity in the house and you wanted to take more money at a lower rate for a longer term, you would go back to the bank and do what's called a refinance. Here you'd be doing, the difference is, you'd be doing a refinance with only one spouse. The other spouse would be gone. Of course, the problem here is two spouses earn more than one spouse, and the spouse who goes to the bank and says, I want to do a refinance, generally has to be a pretty strong income producer and good credit in order to achieve a refinance. Now, you know, and then you'd end up going to a closing, and you'd sign new mortgage documents, and the one spouse who's not living in the house would both be taken off of the loan. They would be discharged from the loan, the existing loan, and they would also give up their interest in half of the property to the spouse who was remaining beyond. So that's one way of what people call getting off of the loan, is the refi. Then, you know, because the remaining spouse may not have, you know, sufficient credit, there is a concept of just living in the house, leaving things the way they are, and crossing your fingers that the spouse who is in the house keeps paying the mortgage. So that is a little problematic, because the spouse that's out of the house always has this loan hanging over their head, and they never know when the axe is actually going to come down, or the other shoe fall, because they're beholden. They're not in the house. They may not have any idea of if the loan payments are being made or not, or can be made. And if the spouse who's in the house can't pay, won't pay, stops paying, then it becomes a problem for the spouse that's out, because now they're out of the house and the bank is sending them notices that, if you don't pay up, they're going to try to foreclose on your house. So,
if you don't sell, I guess it's probably best to just be roommates then, if you can't sell the house.
Well,
but in the situation you're describing, where the one spouse is then out of the house, what about that person if they wanted to go apply for another mortgage post divorce?
Well, they could. That the person who's you're saying the person who's in the house.
Or whoever, if the person out of the house and wants to maybe purchase an apartment or something, where, you know, they then need to go apply for another mortgage after they're divorced and have this scenario.
Yeah, well, that's a problem, because your credit, you know, report will show that you owe Citibank $100,000, and you're applying for yet another loan for a place where you're going to live. And the lender, as a general rule, does not like to lend to people who own two houses. They worry about, you know, can you carry, you know, both of the houses. So that'll be a significant drag on the spouse that's out of the house getting, you know, more credit if they wanted to buy something in the future. So, you know, they call you, say, you know, the concept of living together. Well, that you see that occasionally, you know, people, you know, you live in the basement, I'll live on the top floor, and we'll share the middle floor. They keep paying the expenses, you know, chip in to pay the expenses. Sometimes that's referred to as staying married to the mortgage or staying married to the house. You know, you're divorced and yet live together. That's probably a slightly safer route if for some reason the out of, you know, the spouse who was supposed to get out of the house or the spouse that was staying in the house couldn't either refi or somehow get the other person's name off the loan via an assumption. That presents very peculiar results, but I have known people who have lived together after the divorce because, you know, to sell your house, you're going to incur certain expenses. To get a new house, you're going to incur new expenses, or rental, you're going to incur expenses. So some couples may think, hey, we're divorced, we'll live in separate parts of the house. We don't have to worry about our housing, you know, situation because we have it already. But that is a unique situation and probably something that would make for some sort of reality show on cable TV, you know, sometime in the future. Maybe we ought to think about, you know, that couples who live together after divorce. That might be a very interesting reality show.
Yep. Well, excuse me, we're at almost the end of our legal topics episode. Is there anything else you wanted to add on this really interesting and hopefully a rare occurrence?
Well, you know, just you know, the general thought that a divorce is a very difficult mental and sometimes physical event, and it has serious financial ramifications. And generally, when the couple pops out at the other end of the divorce tunnel or pipeline, they are in worse financial situation than they were when they're together. And, you know, a loan on your house is certainly one of the bigger issues that you have to deal with, and it would be it's really a huge drag on future potential, you know, to borrow other money. And it's always questionable whether or not you can keep up the house. So it is a very, it's almost a very disastrous situation. Probably the less stressful thing to do is to sell, end the misery, end the fear, and, you know, the future fear that the one couple, that one party may default and the bank come after you. So as painful as it may seem, probably the sale of the house right at the point of the divorce or shortly thereafter is probably a better way to keep your sanity.
And with that, we're at the end of our legal topics episode. And, again, another interesting topic that we've covered. Bob, why don't you take us out?
Well, this concludes tonight's radio show, our legal topic show, in which we talked about breaking up the mortgage after divorce and how it is a very difficult situation in an otherwise very painful, you know, lawsuit. This is House New York signing off. God bless Brooklyn and all of his people. Wishing you a good night and a good morning and a good afternoon. I'm your host, Robert Howe.
Like the folks you meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn.